Hello, and welcome to Dear Franny, the podcast where I have uncommon conversations about love with fascinating people. I'm your host, Francesca Hoagie. This is a special episode. Well, they're all special episodes to me, but in this episode, I talked to one of my dearest friends, Paul Walling. Paul and I have known each other for 20 years, and we've had parallel and sometimes overlapping journeys of self-discovery and exploration over the two decades that we've been friends. So you'll hear all about it, and Paul is hilarious, so be prepared to laugh. This is a really great, entertaining conversation with my friend, Paul Walling.
Today, my guest is a dear, dear friend of mine. Like, truly. How long have we been friends?
Oh, my gosh. Well, since we first met, which was in 1999.
Oh, my God.
Coming up on 20 years.
20 years.
Oh, my God. We were 7 years old.
We were years old in 1999, and here we are, millennials coming to our own.
Finally.
Here we are joined by Paul Walling.
Hello.
My beautiful friend, super talented actor, writer, director, producer, just man about town.
I am about the town.
And it is also very appropriate that we are doing this interview in your screening room.
Yes.
Because you and I have quite the filmic connection.
That was really the start of our bond, I think.
Yeah.
Even though we were in law school at the time, I think we started talking about movies immediately. I feel like it was in the shuttle in Minneapolis.
Oh, my God. Okay.
A shuttle bus.
I'm going to interrupt you for a second.
Okay.
So, right. Paul has the most ridiculous memory. And it's been 20 years of him being like, you know, you remember, we were sitting at that diner and you ordered hot chocolate and you asked for no whipped cream. And then and I'm like, none of these things. I don't remember any of these things.
And yet I can't remember my next door neighbor's name. I'm like, oh, hey, Tom.
Oh,
for 3
God.
Months, I called this guy Tom.
What's his name?
Jim.
Ooh.
Yeah.
He finally corrected you?
The front desk had to tell me.
Oh.
Because I was like, hey, I looked into Tom's apartment, and it looked like he's moved out. Is that the case? And they just stared at me, and they go, you mean Jim? And I'm telling you, every day that I saw him in the hallway, I was so proud of myself.
Hey,
Tom.
So did you fess up?
I did. Next time I saw him in the hallway, yeah. I was like, I have to apologize.
Okay,
you know,
good.
I've been calling you Tom, and I know your name is Jim. And it made me feel much better because he was like, wait, what's your name again? And either he was covering very well or he genuinely like could care less about my name. I was like, it's VP. He's like, oh, okay, cool. So I was worrying about, you know, something for no reason, which is often what we do.
Which is often what we do. I actually had a moment yesterday where I was reminded of that, like, why do I ever bother worrying about shit?
Exactly.
It's rehearsed suffering is what it is.
Ooh, I like that.
Like, you're just rehearsing suffering just in case.
That is so true.
You might have to suffer. But what, does that make the suffering any less? It doesn't.
I like to think that I've gotten to that point where I don't obsess over little things like that. But every once in a while, something like that will creep in. But I think largely I've been able to avoid that in my life lately, you know, and not overthink something that's probably going to change. Like, as an actor, when you go in, you know, you may have all of your lines down, which I try to do, but inevitably they're going to throw something new at you.
Yeah.
So if you're stumbling over a particular phrase or, you know, not connecting one line to the next, it's kind of inevitable that it's going to fix itself or it's going to get even worse. So
just, but that's what happens.
Exactly.
That's what happens.
So just be ready for change,
that's
I guess
what
is
happens.
What. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Which is kind of a larger, I guess, theme. To our relationship, too.
Yeah, you know? There's been so much change.
A lot of change.
So we were 7-year-olds in law school. Very advanced.
Very. Two prodigies plucked right off the playground. Out of the sandbox.
At the University of Michigan Law School. And so at that time, obviously, we were both planning on careers in the law.
That's right.
Well, you were at that time interested in politics.
That's right.
That was your original.
Yeah. I figured I would have to work at a law firm for a few years before I ran for the U.S. Senate. Until I turned 30, I was constitutionally able to run for Senate. No. I thought my career was going to be in politics in Florida, where I grew up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what was the thing that changed that?
Honestly, the pinpoint that I can see in my memory was Bush v. Gore. And being in law school at that time and kind of losing all my faith in all the institutions that we learned were fail-safe.
Yeah.
And there it was, you know, Supreme Court in my home state. And mind you, I was one of those absentee ballots that was being counted because I'd voted from Michigan in my home state. And thankfully, my county was not one that was in dispute. But it was so distressing to see that go down the way it did, not just because I was a big Gore supporter or, you know, lifelong Democrat, but because the Supreme Court really didn't, like, let it run its course, that they stepped in with no precedent and said, you gotta shut this down.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait, what? But we're in law school learning about the Supreme Court of the land.
Like, I know.
Is above reproach. And suddenly it was reproachable.
And it's gotten even worse.
Yeah. You think? Oh, I haven't heard. I tuned it all out.
So, oh my gosh. Let's not talk about politics. But you had always a love of performing. And you always had a love of storytelling. And you were a performer your whole life.
Yeah, I really was. I mean, I started doing it officially in like some kind of organized fashion when I was in sixth grade. And I got cast in the school play. And I was just like, this is it. I love this. And so I started doing it in Tampa, and I did it all the way through high school and did, you know, what we call professional productions. And we had Orlando only an hour and a half away, which had Universal Studios and Disney was doing stuff. Occasionally I'd go over there and do something. But yeah, once I finished high school, I was like, well, I guess that's that. You know, there were no examples of people of my age or like generation that had gone on to make careers out of that. And then this guy, Patrick Wilson, did it. And he was one of our contemporaries that I was like, oh, well, I guess I could have gone to school for that. Come to find out, oh, well, now I'm into politics. And I also really love journalism. So when I first went to college, I thought I was going to be a broadcast journalist.
Okay.
Which is another thing we have in common, at least in terms of your education.
Yeah, because I studied TV, radio, and film production undergrad. Right. That's what my degree is in from Syracuse. I think, for both, for me, going to law school, it wasn't really a great decision. I mean, it wound up being great for my life. I'm not complaining, you know, go blue. And I certainly wouldn't be sitting here with you. There's so many people.
That's the greatest thing.
Who I'm like, how could, I can't imagine. My life would be, if I had not met you, I don't even know.
Oh, Franny.
Seriously.
I feel the same. I feel the same. That's so sweet of you to say.
No, but it's true.
But I feel like it's all in reverse of that, that my life would not be what it is.
Oh, you stop it.
Well, first of all, I really don't think I'd still be in LA. And I don't know that my acting career would have ever restarted, you know, because had I not started in LA, I probably would have flamed out in New York on the theater scene because I didn't have the training at the time, you know, that I was coming out of law school.
Yeah.
I had to go and get that there. But I didn't have the confidence, certainly, that I've been able to build up in my career here.
Yeah.
So the fact that you're such an L.A. rah-rah booster.
I sure am.
It's true.
Everybody move to L.A., but don't bring your car.
Yes. I will side off on that.
No more cars. But, for people who don't know us and know our history, just to kind of give our listeners here a bit of some backstory here. So, okay, first of all, I need to explain to the listeners. So my guest today is Paul Walling. That is his name, but I call him VP.
That's right.
As do many of his old friends. So if you hear me saying VP, I'm talking about Paul.
Yeah. A lot of people, I think, especially in dating and, you know, when they meet me with old friends or family, they think I'm hiding behind my initials when in actuality, from birth, my family called me VP.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So they named me Vernon Paul after two family members, but it's always been VP. So it's funny because I have to convince people that, like, Paul is the fake name.
Right.
VP is the real name.
Right.
So it takes a while for them to believe me on that front.
So VP and I, we went to law school together. We bonded over many things, but one was our love of movies. And so after we graduated, we went our separate ways. Kind of.
I mean, we were always in touch, but
We were always in touch, but we wound up reconnecting. I was in New York. I was working at a law firm as a corporate lawyer. It like, feels like a million years ago. I was a 10-year-old corporate lawyer.
You should have seen her with her wagon and full of briefs.
And I don't even remember. I think maybe through Erin, through my friend Erin, who obviously you know very well, I'd gotten this invitation to go to the opening ceremony of the inaugural Tribeca Film Festival at City Hall.
That's right.
And so I go, and Bill Clinton is there, and Robert
Nelson
De Niro is
Mandela.
There. Nelson Mandela is there. It's
insane.
Like an insane assemblage of people. That was the first time I met Bill Clinton, and I was like, oh, this man has charisma. He might have a future in politics or something. And And who do I run into?
Me.
There he is.
Yep.
VP Walling. And VP Paul Walling.
I had the same reaction about seeing you there. I was like, of course you're here. Duh.
And so that was the catalyst for us starting to talk about starting a production company.
That's right.
Which we did.
Yeah.
And
we
so
sure did.
I quit my law job, yep. You know, my big firm job to move to LA and start a production company with you. Yep. And Frank
leap
and
of Walt, faith.
Leap of faith. That was the first big, bold move I made in my life ever.
Really?
Yeah.
That surprises me.
Are you kidding me?
Really?
Well, first of all, I was only 10. So
you're really
that.
Sticking with that narrative.
You know what?
I like
it.
Doogie Howser was so old compared to us, 7-year-olds in law school.
But up until then, I was always doing the safe thing. I didn't go to law school like wanting to be a lawyer. I studied film production undergrad. Like, I wanted to make movies.
But a lot of people would say that direction, that school is not, you know, your safest. It's not a business school. It's not accounting.
So that's the thing. I went and I worked on movies as a PA right out of college. Mm-hmm. And I had some bad experiences. I had a producer put his hand down my pants in front of like a group full of people. No one did anything. I was just like, this is not the route for me. Mm-hmm. I can't be this low person on the totem pole who people can just treat however they want. I didn't know what else to do.
Wow.
So I went to law school.
Wow.
Well, it wasn't like I, you know.
I feel like we've talked about this in the past, but I can't remember what your initial instinct of going to law school was. When was that? Like, was it when you were an undergrad? Was it not
no,
until after
it wasn't
that
until
experience?
After. It wasn't until after.
Really?
Yeah. And I was really just like, and I had like my favorite uncle was like, well, you know, if you want to make money and have a professional career, like you need to get a grad degree, pick a grad program. And I was like, Well, there's no math on the LSAT.
Yep, that's true.
And that's why I went to law school.
Wow.
Because there's no math on the LSAT.
Yeah, we have a mutual friend, Stephanie, who I sat next to in our torts class first year. And there was one day when Professor Sherman Clark like started doing formulas on how they calculate settlements.
Oh.
And everybody's like eyes just glazed
her,
over.
Like, why?
And she literally raised her hand and she said, I was told there'd be no math. And she meant it in law school. She's like, what are you doing?
I will refuse to be tested on this. Refuse.
He's like, it's not going to be on the final. She's like, it better not be. I was told there'd be no math.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
So anyway, long story short, that was my first bold move. So we lived together. So we were roommates and business partners for 5 years.
I mean, I really have to say that, like, my hat is off to you because I was already out here. I was clerking for a judge.
Mm-hmm.
I had already started working for a couple who worked in Hollywood as their assistant before I went to law school,
mm-hmm.
stayed in touch with them. So I knew I had a bit of a safety net. You know, if the producing thing didn't work out, there were other things. But you really did give up, you know, something that was extremely stable where they loved you rightfully,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you were doing well, but you were.
Yeah, I was.
You
I
know?
Was. I was doing well. I think about that. I'm like, I could be a partner at a law firm right now.
Yeah.
But instead.
You love Los Angeles. You love doing your own thing. And I'm glad you do because I'm glad that you made that leap. And it wasn't exactly the way that we planned it either. Because I remember I always tell people, maybe this is false memory, but that I was just going along with you to look at apartments because I already had my apartment a block away that was, you know, a little hovel.
You were open.
But I was like open to
it. You were open to moving.
Yeah, I was like, if we find something big enough.
And then we found the most amazing apartment ever.
And we found that. And
legendary.
That was it. Legendary.
We had a legendary apartment here in LA.
Yep.
And all of our friends, all of our family can tell you how legendary that apartment was.
That's right.
And how many parties we had and how many house guests. I mean, it was like...
Yeah.
I mean, I remember, I think our max number of house guests, like at one, I remember there was one night and we had something like 17.
17,
guests. Yeah. And I was like, this is a lot of people staying in our apartment.
There's still room for more.
It was an amazing apartment.
Yeah,
it was
great.
It was great.
It really was.
Good times, good times. So one big change that happened between when I first met you and now.
Yeah, pretty soon after.
It was a few years in.
Yeah.
Was you came out.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, it was funny because I always had that inkling. I do believe in the, you know, born this way thing. But I thought that I was kind of destined to just be bad at dating because, you know, A, I wanted to be a politician from Florida. There were no examples. When I went to college, I started in Washington, D.C. and interned on the Hill. And there were very few examples at that point. I think it was only Barney Frank was the only out member of Congress mm-hmm. on either side mm-hmm. of the Capitol. You know, I was like, well, I'm going to have to be closeted if I act on these urges. Mm-hmm. And I was pretty nerdy and like focused on my goals. And law school was one of them at that point. And so I really wasn't dating or being sexually active at all mm-hmm. when I started college. And so I was just like, well, if I just deny, you know, my urges, I just won't have to do anything about them. And it wasn't until I built up some more confidence and kind of really sat down and thought about what I wanted to do in the world that I was like, well, a large part of life is finding somebody that you love. And when I finally faced that, you know, it was pretty much halfway through law school. And so I started to do it quietly on my own, kind of like the acting thing. You mm-hmm. know, I started doing it. You know? No, I won't tell anybody that I'm doing this just yet. But I was like, yeah, that's what it is. Mm-hmm. You know, I am gay. Mm-hmm. I do have to like act on these very real, you know,
yeah, you
real
knew who
feelings.
You were. Yeah. Yeah.
And so, yeah, you were one of the first people that I told, of course, because, you know, one of my dearest friends, kindred spirit, sister, I just, you know, I remember it was like your second time visiting L.A. before we even decided to do the, you were out here for a wedding with Patty, I think.
Oh, yeah.
I took you to FUBAR. For those not in the know, it's a pretty divey gay bar here in LA, in West Hollywood, and pretty raunchy. And we walked in there, and I was like, oh yeah, by the way, this is my local bar, and I'm gay.
No, that's not how it happens.
I'm gonna rewrite history.
We were driving in your car, in your Jeep.
Okay, yeah.
And we were in
clue number one.
I think we
Jeep
were in
Wrangler.
Top down Pacific Palisades.
Oh yeah,
and that's
yeah.
that's when you told me.
Okay,
that's yeah. when you told me, and well, I was like, oh,
yeah,
cool,
you're
whatever.
Incredibly supportive. I mean, like you great. Always have been. You always have been. Oh. I've never had an inkling of, you know, feeling of being judged by you, which is really a rare thing, you know, because in life,
thank you.
We go through life, I think, expecting judgment, like kind of goes back to what we were saying before about being, what did you say, rehearsing nervousness?
Rehearsing suffering.
I think that's what we do so much because we expect it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I've never had that feeling with you.
Yeah, I've never had that feeling with you either.
Well, that's pretty cool.
That's why we're friends 20 years later.
I guess so. Yeah.
I think we're going to make it to 30.
I think so. If we can make it through this podcast.
So you and I actually, so when we were first living in LA together, I think we were both on a path of a lot of exploration and a lot of self-discovery and had a lot of sex.
Yeah.
Not with each other.
Not with each other.
It's really interesting. And I'm sure for you, you probably have more sort of an insight to actually a side of me than most, probably anyone does. Hmm. Because we lived together in that time.
Same roof, yeah.
And because that was a time in my life where I was the most like coming into my own and like figuring out like, oh, okay, maybe there are guys who do like me and maybe I can be sexy and maybe I can be more confident. And you kind of saw that. I mean, I don't know if it was how aware you were of that was, because I think
I
a lot of that
aware.
Was like pretty internal.
To me, it seemed like you were coming into understanding what the friends and family who love you the most already saw in you.
Aww.
That you were adventurous, that you already had a spirit, that if you let yourself go, you mm-hmm. know, that you would try things and you know, excel.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting because I think all of us have that in some part of our life, whether it's professionally or dating.
Well, you have it in so many parts of your life.
I don't know. I mean, maybe.
You've had some dating adventures.
I have, definitely.
And
I've been pretty open about them, you know, because I feel like that's part of our journey, you know, is like figuring out who we are, what we like, what we don't like,
mm-hmm.
you know, trying everything 3 times. I really should stop doing that.
So you tried something that was interesting.
Oh, what? Please be more specific.
Actually, I did tell this story already.
Yeah.
On my previous podcast, Romantical.
Oh, okay.
And you know about it because you were like, you texted me, you were like, that's me. So obviously, I did not reveal any names. You know what I'm talking about.
I do, but remind me. Remind the listeners.
You had a sex slave.
Yeah.
and your sex slave installed my blinds in my apartment for me at your behest.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
So let's talk about what that was like for you.
The dom sub culture, dom slash sub space culture, is an interesting one to me because I never was really aware of it until I was getting repeated in the age of Craigslist, which we can go off on a whole other
a whole other tangent.
I was getting these repeated entreaties to enter this world as a dom, as an alpha male.
So they were just guys seeing your profile.
Yeah, and they were like, would you ever consider owning me?
Oh my God.
And I was like, I don't understand. And like I said, I'll try anything three times. And so I was like, okay, well, this is interesting. There's something to my personality. And I think it's all about yin yang in life, you know, that you have to find balance. And you could say that that's because I'm a Libra. But I mean, it's basically any time that, you know, there's something very intense in one direction of my life, I try and balance it at least, you know, moderately on the other side.
Yeah.
And I think that when you're a creative, and especially, you know, in the business we are in, but at the time, like trying to get something off the ground from nothing, producing films, you know, you're at the bottom of the totem pole, as you mentioned earlier, and it's not a great place to be when you're used to being a high-achieving person.
Yeah.
And so I think there's something that spoke to me about that, where I was like, yeah, this is great. Somebody already sees me in this way, and I can balance out the feeling of lack of control in this other part of my life with this.
So do you think that it's because, I mean, you're a very straight appearing, you know, gay man. You are very, you know, masculine in that very traditional way.
Yeah. Cis-hetero presenting.
Very cis-hetero presenting. Yeah. You have trouble with some guys believing that you're actually
gay,
right?
Yeah.
But do you think, is that why the submissives were drawn to you? Part of the dynamic?
I think so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think there's also just there's a confidence that certain people have in life. It comes across even before sometimes people meet you, you know, whether it's just through the way you take a photo or the photos you choose to post or the way you write. It was chosen for me in some ways. Yeah.
So what was that experience like? So for people who are like, what are we talking about?
So, what I started to say was that the whole culture, you know, what I came to know it as was dom sub. Mm-hmm. And I was always and still have this like level of kind of like unease.
Discomfort with those
with
terms?
Sex slave.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, and the ones who like are like, you know, I'm going to make sure that every time I refer to myself, it's in lowercase. And every time I refer to you, it's in all caps.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this whole like subculture.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's funny, like when I hear it, you know, out loud, it's different than seeing it written.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, ooh.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah, I'm a sex slave.
I know. It's uncomfortable language, to say the
it
least.
It is. It is. But
what does it look like? So obviously, he did things for you.
Yeah.
Like nothing to do with sex at all. Right.
It was more about servitude, you know, and being in service. And again, as I said, you know, that it's the yin yang. They tend to be people who are high functioning in, you know, the rest of their lives.
Yeah, and they need that
high responsibility.
Yeah.
And they need that balance.
So interesting.
You know, to be put in their place.
Yeah.
Quote unquote. Yeah.
Yeah. Gosh, wow. It's just, that's just like so unappealing to me.
What is it that's unappealing?
I'm happy to do things for people, but like, I need there to be balance.
Yeah.
I need there to be balance.
Yeah.
You know?
So you find your balance in a different way.
Yeah.
You know, than somebody else who's like, I'm going to find this as a counterbalance to this other part of my life where I run my own business and, you know, people depend on me.
Yeah.
I'm going to come and, you know, I'm going to depend on this person to tell me everything and tell me, you know, like what to do and where to eat my food and what to bring them from the refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like.
My current boyfriend does not do this, but I should tell him about this. But I had an ex-boyfriend who used to order food for me.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted him to. I just feel like you just pick.
Yeah.
And it was great. I loved that.
Yeah.
Like,
he chose stuff that you were just like, no, this is unappetizing.
No, because we really had the same taste in food.
Okay.
And we shared always. So it was like, if ever, like, he ordered me something that I was sort of like, oh, I like what you had better, he would just give it to me.
Yeah.
I don't know. I liked it, though. It was like, it, for me, I felt like, especially at that time, because this was back in my lawyer days. Mm-hmm. So this was post-producing, but back into the law, just for people who are keeping track of our biography here. Hollywood is a really tough business. I was like, I love movies. I don't have to make them. This isn't what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. I got to figure this out. So I went back into the law because I didn't know what else to do. And I had a very, at this time, a very... Like, I worked a lot of hours. I had a really demanding job. Mm-hmm. I was managing, like, lots of people. And so I was, like, in full-on boss mode, like, all the time. And so I did. So I, for him, ordering my food, it was just like, I don't want to think about it.
Something you don't have to think about.
I don't think about it. And so it felt very caretaking. Yeah. Just be like, you know.
But there's a part of me also that, like, revels and enjoys thinking about the irony of it all, too. Because... As I said, these people were reaching out to me. They were in control of the situation.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet they were asking for no control.
Yeah.
And yet it was on their, when they could do it, when they were available. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So there's something to be said that it's kind of giving up control in name or in play. You know, when in reality, you know, you could say like they never gave up control.
Yeah. Well, they could always, they could also walk away at any time. At any time. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, so that, that's something that obviously you experimented with. Are you, is that something that's
not ongoing? I mean,
are you still getting people reaching out to you and wanting that?
Every once in a while. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you even see it now. It's, you know, the code is less there now that like there's online hookup apps and, you know, kind of the abbreviations or, you know, code words, you know, are out in the zeitgeist more. You see it more. I mean, even in straight up Tinder dating situations, you know, there are those people who have over time figured out this is exactly what I want. This is what I need. You know, this is all I'm looking for.
This is for me. Yeah.
And they're good at articulating that. I wish I was better at that sometimes. I came out, as you said, rather late, especially considering, you know, how soon kids are coming out these days. But I was 26, 27 by the time I did. And I, you know, I justified, you know, kind of dating like a teenager for 10, 15 years.
Yeah, because you were like starting, you were starting the process that
everybody,
you know,
else,
a lot of people start when they're 13, 14, 15, 16. Do you feel now like you've gotten that kind of catching up?
I've gotten it out of my system much.
I know. I got that out of my system, too, a long time ago. I'm like, okay, I'm good. I was like, okay, yeah, you know what? There are guys that like me. I'm good now.
I'm good. Yeah. Okay. Confidence regained.
I'll just, there'll just be one guy that I'm just going to be with now.
Yeah. I mean, I think, as you well know, you know, and the fact that you're such an expert in this realm has helped me, you know, considerably as well, even just listening to, you know, your other podcast and knowing you through life. And I mean, you've met every significant boyfriend I've ever had, for sure. And you know, the experience of like having somebody like you that you can turn to and be like, doing this behavior, it's okay, right? Or this behavior is a little crazy, right? Okay, I'm going to stop doing that. But you've also pulled me back from going to the other end of the spectrum and being like, I'm not dating. I'm not dating at all. And you're like, come on, you date.
Come on,
yes, you are.
Let's not be ridiculous.
Yeah, you're not going to stop dating forever. All right, okay, fine. I'll go back out on one more date. Yeah, so you know, it's not something I would rule out forever, but no, currently it's not what I'm seeking.
Do you think that being openly gay in Hollywood and single, is that something that's like, is that, how much of a factor is that in your life and your career, like?
First, I have to recommend, if you haven't heard it yet, this podcast, Homophilia, which Dave Holmes, who you know, who I dated briefly back in the day, lovely Dave Holmes, and Matt McConkie, I think is his co-host name. They have this great podcast, and they just had Andrew Scott, the hot priest from the second season of Fleabag, on. And Andrew Scott went off about the term openly gay. He's like, it really, you know, gets under my skin.
Yeah, it is a bad term.
He's like, you know, they don't say you're openly American or you're openly Irish. You know, it's like, he's like, it's like you're, you know, you're doing something bad. You're doing this thing. And so one of them suggested, I think Dave said, defiantly gay. And he's like, yeah, I'm gonna own that. I'm defiantly gay. But I mean, I'm fine with openly gay. Anyway, just a little side note. Feel free to cut that out.
No, I love it.
Yeah, being openly gay and single, I think, is the default, sadly. You know, it's like there are those who are in relationships. But for me, it's never been, maybe because I again, came to it late, both being, you know, out and acting. I was already pretty much a fully formed adult, you know, by the time I was doing both of those things.
Yeah.
And I think I've never looked over my shoulder. I've never, like, really wondered about it. You know, it's never been a question of, like, ooh, should I hide this side of my life? I think people don't really care. You know, when you look a certain way, which is, you know, if anybody's watching this on video, unwashed. And as I like to say, my stylist is the first four things I see on the floor of my apartment as I leave. That's what I wear. And gray hair, you know, and the beard that, you know, you don't really trim that
it's
often.
It's very trim right now.
It is. Well, that's because I did that commercial on Friday.
Yeah,
and they trimmed
I was going
to
say, because you're sometimes you're really
pretty
looking
bushy.
like a sea captain.
Yeah. Very diplomatic way of putting it. I was ready for homeless.
Homeless person.
Homeless sea captain is my vibe. But when you look a certain way, I don't think the world really cares that much whether you're gay or straight, except the people who are really into you. And I've been very, very, very fortunate that there have been at least
a lot
few
of people
that have been
really
into it.
Really
so
into
that,
it, yeah.
That told me something, you know, that was like, be yourself, which is, you know, a message we receive constantly from society, but I think you really have to internalize it by feeling it.
Yeah. Well, we receive that message on the one hand as like advice, but then everything else in society is telling you, no.
Be like this
person. Be like this, actually. Be like this. This is what success looks like. This is what beauty looks like. This is all, you know. So you mentioned something about, you know, kids coming out. And, you know, obviously you came out in your 20s. What do you think about, like, do you have an opinion? Like, do you, when you look back at, you know, really actual 7-year-old VP, do you think that was someone who understood that he was gay?
I think so. Yeah, I think he definitely did, you know, not in those terms. My family life has informed so much of my worldview. And, you know, it was tumultuous when I was a kid. I come from a very blended family of older siblings, half siblings, and younger half siblings, and I'm the only child between my parents. So I think it's informed the way I look at the world. But what I saw a lot of when I was growing up was coupling and uncoupling, and marriages and divorces, and dating and pregnancy, and you know, it was tumultuous. And so that was another factor that kind of pushed me more into my own head and to what I wanted to do as a career more than as a, you know, building a family life.
Yeah. Did you have a romantic longing when you were a kid?
I don't think so. I mean,
I had so much romantic longing as a kid.
Now that you say it that way, I guess I did.
I think it really for me started probably around 7.
Yeah.
But by 9, it was full on.
Wow.
Second year of
law school.
I was like, you know, reading like the Bronte sisters and like reading Jane Austen.
See, I was reading Shel Silverstein.
I was reading Shel Silverstein too, and Judy Blume too. I was reading my sister's, because my sister, you know, as you know, is 12 years older than me, so she had these.
Hi, Jonna.
Shout out to my big sis. So she was a big fan of like Sidney Sheldon novels.
Oh wow!
And they were
steamy.
And I started reading those when I was like 10 years old.
Wow!
And I remember my mom catching me reading one, and she's like, "You're too young to read that book."
Wow!
And I was like, "Okay." And I snuck and read all of them. I was like, "Now I'm gonna read all of them." So I had
nice
all
try,
of these,
Joyce.
Like,
nice try.
So my head was filled with all of these very romantic, you know, ideas about just passion and adventure and unrequited love, you know, all of that. And so I was totally taken by that.
You know, I think I was aware of all of the messages that were out there that were accessible to us when you said Judy Blume. I was like, oh yeah, I read all those Judy Blumes. But I think I glossed over, as you may remember.
I don't think a lot of boys read Judy Blume.
Well, I think I was aware of that too. And yeah. I think I hid them in the bottom of my backpack under the Peanuts, you know,
the
Charlie Brown comics, you know, that I also checked out from the library at the same time. But I also, I mean, there was a part of me that was kind of like bold about it.
Checking out books in the library.
Oh, yeah. I remember exactly.
Those were the days.
In my elementary school, I remember exactly the walls of books that I was into and like going through all of them. Yeah. But I remember glossing over the parts that were not like icky, but like just less than interesting to me. Mm-hmm. You know, it was more about the like, oh, okay, what is it to be a teenager? And wow, that's pretty complicated for women. Like there were belts and pads and grandmothers and secrets and whispering. And I was just like, whoa.
Yeah. So when was your first crush?
When you asked that question earlier, what popped into my head was the quarterback of the Cincinnati Bengals.
Ooh.
When I was like 9 or 10. Uh-huh. I was still in elementary school, but his name was Kenny Anderson.
Uh-huh.
And I made up this elaborate lie to people that he was like in my family. Because my mom's side of the family is from Ohio. Just to justify how obsessed I was with this guy. So if you're out there, Kenny Anderson.
That's amazing.
Yeah. No, I think that was the first thought of a crush. In person, it probably wasn't until, I don't know, junior high, high school. But I probably conflated that with like friendship.
Mm.
Because again, you know, like growing up the way that I did, I think my mindset until my younger brother and sister got older was that I was an only child, that I was the baby of the family on one side, but like that I was an only child, that I had to seek out, you know, siblings, peers of my age, and that I had to like, you know, like find friends.
Yeah.
That was the most important thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you did such a good job of that because you have like more friends than anyone.
Well, I hope that it's quality over quantity, but I am lucky in that, you know, I've had some good quality friends.
Yeah.
Over the years,
yeah,
including you.
Oh,
you're at the top
on.
Of the list.
Go on. I mean, really, go on.
Top.
Seriously.
Okay. So the reasons I love Franny
go
are.
So, okay. So I want to ask you how you made the transition from political aspiration, clerking for a judge, being an independent producer to acting in this career that you've built for yourself.
You know, as you said, I think I was always a performer to some degree. And once I got to do it and got a taste of like a proper stage and audience, I was like, ah, that's a great feeling. It's fleeting.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to do that as often as possible. And so I think when I got to the point where I was like, I miss that in my life, I miss that creative feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you and I were toiling away, we would occasionally get notes back that were, you know, encouraging.
Yeah.
But usually people expected that what we wanted from them is, this is how you do it differently. This is how you can fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just defeating to be like, oh, okay, that instinct you had at the beginning that was so good about finding this material or working with this writer.
So you didn't like the feeling of being defeated, so you decided to become an actor?
Exactly. That's how messed up I am.
Literally no more rejecting profession for anyone. The superstar box office darling. Or you're like, it's like literally there is no more.
Oh God, what am I doing?
Back to square one. Just kidding.
Can I go back to law school? Well, keep in mind that like I came from this relatively small city, Tampa, and had been, you know, a relatively big fish in a small pond, acting wise. And I was a piece of work, you know, like in high school, I was like, you're going to give me this part, right? I'm going to get the lead in Grease. And then I didn't get it.
Ooh.
And the teacher director came up to me and was like, you need to check your attitude. I was a junior in high school.
See, you would have gotten like, it, I bet, if you had just
been
more humble.
I was Vince Fontaine. And then the next day, the guy who had gotten cast couldn't do it anymore. And I heard it through the grapevine, and then I saw her across the hallway in school, and she looked at me, and she's like, yeah, you're it.
Oh,
like,
my
reluctantly.
God.
So that put me in check, you know? And I was like, okay, just because you have, you know, the height and the look and some semblance of talent, it's not enough. You know, you have to, A, be humble, but B, you know, like, actually work. You know, don't just, like, mail it in.
Yeah.
So I came back to acting with, you know, I think, you know, a clearer mind and a clearer head, you know, that I needed to get the training, that I needed to affirm that, like, I could do it outside of a small market like Tampa or outside of high school. Mm-hmm. And so when I did it very quietly and, you know, stepped gingerly into that world, and thankfully had a great teacher and mentor who encouraged me to continue mm-hmm. acting and said that I had something as long as I, you know, kept working at it. But yeah, for me, I've never equated acting with rejection.
That's great.
And there's something, off in my brain that just is like, okay, next one. Well, yeah. I wasn't right for you on this one.
Yeah.
Okay. Whatever. I hope you find the right one. Great. I've never really carried through an animosity, you know, or a need to be validated in that way.
That's
for me, it's like
really
every part I get, there's it's out there. Mm-hmm. There's an abundance, you know, that I wish I could apply to the rest of my life. You know,
can.
I know I can, but I wish I was as effective.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and maybe it's just that I've been doing the acting longer.
Yeah, yeah, it's just going to take more work to shift the perspective. We all have those areas, those stubborn areas. So you basically had two coming outs because you came out as gay and then you had to come out as an actor.
Exactly.
Which one was harder?
I thought you were a lawyer, and I was like, I was an actor playing a law student for 3 years. That's a really, really good question. I think the one that was more easily received was coming out as gay.
I believe it.
Yeah, for sure. For mm-hmm. sure. I had the same nervousness about, you know, being rejected that anybody does, but I'm very fortunate that my family is woke.
Yeah.
If I may.
Yeah. Because it was never even a blip in your family.
I had
right?
that day, you know, of like, I don't mm-hmm. know. And honestly, I couldn't do it in person with my dad because I really had this sense of I'm going to be rejected based on no evidence of him ever rejecting any of us, mm-hmm. you know, or anyone in my life. Mm-hmm. I still had that moment where I was like, well, this is where it's going to happen. And it's going to be so awkward. So I actually came out to him on the plane home to L.A. I typed up this email pre-Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. So as soon as I got home and plugged in my computer to the internet, it went out. Yeah. And I knew the next day I was either going to be rejected or accepted. Mm-hmm. Well, surprise, I was very accepted. So thanks, Dad. And my family was
great.
Shout
out to Bruce.
However, no, he's still good in the story. My whole family is. When it came time to acting, to do acting, I think a lot of people were like, why? You know, if they knew me before, they were like, I thought you already got that out of your system. I thought you already determined that, you know, that's not a life career choice.
Yeah.
Unless you went to school for it. Unless you know, were a child actor.
Since you were 12.
Yeah, Neil mm-hmm. Patrick Harris. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what everybody thinks of in terms of my, you know, generation. And so that was a more difficult road to tread, I think, mm-hmm. because people tend to just think that it's a hobby, mm-hmm. you know, and mm-hmm. that you're going to phase out of it. Mm-hmm. And there have been those times, you know, where I'm like, if I had a bar membership, you know, if I had taken the bar exam and not realized that I wanted to go into a creative path after law school, mm-hmm. that I would have gone back to it for sure. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't have been as successful as you have been because, quite frankly, I'm not as smart as you. And I did not do as well in law school as you did. And I saw getting into law school as the win because, mm-hmm. you know, here I was coming from this family that nobody had ever gone on to grad school. So I'd already won mm-hmm. by getting in. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, like, I made it through and got to give a speech at the end, I was like, icing on the cake and we're done.
Yeah.
And so had I actually studied hard and maybe passed the bar exam, never would have happened.
I would have.
You would have inevitably gone back to it.
You're not giving yourself nearly enough credit.
Thank you.
You know.
But yeah, the fact that, you know, I wanted to do this because I thought that I could make a happy career and life out of it has been everything.
It takes so much courage because there's so many people, and I don't know, maybe somebody who's listening to this right now is thinking like, wow, they left their careers or they were on this path and they started over. And because people did, I know people judged you for pursuing acting professionally. Yeah, yeah. People judged me for becoming a matchmaker.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was a lot of, I mean, and not even in a, like a, I don't think, I didn't have anybody being like, are you stupid? Like, it wasn't like in a mean way.
Right.
But it was definitely a lot
of
like,
concern.
Yeah, a lot of concern that was clearly showing, like, the person who was expressing their concern, they were showing their worldview, which was like, you don't invest this much time and energy and money, you know, going to law school and practicing law for all these years to like run away and join the circus,
right?
You know, like be a matchmaker. What I was, you know, you're single. Like, what are you talking about? But I mean, obviously I have like beyond supportive people in my family and friends. It's not like, you know, this is not a crime either.
Yeah, it was not a scorched earth, you know, you burned every bridge and had to go off on your own.
Definitely not a crimey river situation.
No.
But it is interesting to see, you know, it takes some courage for us. Like, it's a courage for me to let my bar membership lapse. Like, I'm inactive, you know. I wanted to take it off the table. Yeah. Like, I don't have the option of practicing law now.
Yeah.
So I can't. So now I have to make my business work, you know. Yeah. And I have to do all these other things. So it does take courage to do that, but it also takes courage to deal with other people's expectations of you and saying to people, because I mean, the few people that I'm thinking of, you know, totally well-meaning people, and I just had to say to them, I promise you I'm gonna be okay,
right? And that I'm a grown-up and like, I've thought this through.
Yeah, like I'm gonna be okay,
it's
like,
gonna be fine.
The worst case scenario is I move back in with my mother, which is not a bad thing because I really like my mom.
She's pretty great.
She cooks for me. She's amazing. She's like my favorite person.
That's also my worst case scenario. I'm still holding that out. Sorry, Joyce. You're finding out this way. I might be moving in.
You know, I'm like, this is not, it's going to be okay, you know? So, but so I applaud you.
Well, because thank
that's
you.
Really, that's, I mean, really not easy to do.
You know, I think the current, steady current of our relationship has been like pushing ourselves and supporting each other. I hope you see it that way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You're like my biggest cheerleader.
Likewise. You know, I feel like I've always got your back and you've got mine.
Aww.
So that's pretty cool.
It's very cool. It's very cool. Yeah.
Even when I had to tell you I wouldn't go on Amazing Race with you.
Oh, God. That's right.
Yeah.
I could have maybe just avoided that whole Survivor thing.
If I'd said yes.
If you just said yes to being my Amazing Race partner.
But I told you, as soon as we got cast, I'd be like, that's it. We made it. We're on TV.
Oh, my God. That would have been bad. You're right. You know, sometimes in life it feels like, you know, you're like, wow, things aren't going to a plan. I really wanted this thing. It didn't happen. And I'm so disappointed. But it's always, there's just something else.
Exactly.
It's always just something else that's meant to happen.
And we just got to keep, you know, as trite as it sounds, we got to keep swimming, keep, you know, running the race.
Yeah.
It's a marathon, not a sprint. It's,
that's what they say.
Yeah.
Thank God, because I'm not a fast runner. I'm a very late bloomer. And when if I ever write a memoir, it's going to be called Late Bloomer.
I like that.
Because I feel like I'm, you know.
And it's got so much more meaning now that you're a plant lady.
And now that I'm obsessed with plants, it really, really, really does.
Yeah.
It really does. So yeah, I feel like everything is, you know, everything is late for me. But on
it's
time.
Only, it's on only on other people's schedules.
It's perfectly,
it's
on,
perfectly
time.
On time. It's for you.
I mean, it feels perfectly on time, but it's also
you're
like,
still ahead,
you know,
of the game. You know. I was really fortunate to have a mentor probably 10 years ago now when I was still trying to find my way and find that creative spark that, you know, made life worth living. And I found it in acting. But before that, I went in this direction of theater producing, and I was trying to get this guy to put money into a project. And he had a lot to give. And he was like, you know, here are the reasons that I don't invest in theater, da 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 da. And I was like, okay. And I felt totally defeated. You know, I thought he was the slam dunk that I could get, you know, some investment from this guy. And I was like, I don't know. You know, like, I'm frustrated, but not with you. I'm frustrated that, you know, I feel behind the timeline on all of this, that I should have started doing this part of my career 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, you're ahead of it. You know, like, he made me realize that throughout my life, I've always felt behind, but I was actually ahead of it. And so, as simple and trite as that sounds, you know, I have that voice in the back of my head every time I say, oh, well, I'm too old. You know, I started this too late. I didn't go, you know, get the right degree.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm reminded, you know, that like the path is the path.
Yeah.
You know, it's what got us here.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's past is prologue.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm grateful for that.
I'm so grateful too.
Because
so grateful.
There's so much more that's still coming that we can't even imagine.
I know.
Right?
I think about that all the time. Yeah. Every once in a while, I get really excited. I'm like, anything could happen. Literally anything could happen.
Anything. Yeah.
I'm like, what if it's something amazing?
Exactly. Probably will be.
So I wonder, because one of the things that I had become very convinced of and excited about happening was falling in love, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I feel it. I feel like I'm ready. This is it's ready. It's happening. It's sticking. And when I really felt really convinced of that, that's when I met, you know, my boyfriend, as you know. And I wonder for you, like romantically, like what's the dream now?
You know, that's a really good question. And I think I've got a handle on it, but I haven't really had to articulate it. I think the dream is finding someone who, A, compliments you in the ways that you're, I don't want to say weak, but in the ways that you're lacking, that they somehow fill, you know, that void. Or again, yin-yang is a big thing for me, and balance.
Yeah.
But also somebody who's got the same sense of adventure, because I've often found that first part where I'm like, oh, they're really, you know, type B where I'm type A and vice versa. But I want to go see the world. And they're like, I'm done. I want to sit on the sofa. I want to stay here. I'm, you know, I only like LA. I'm never moving back to New York.
I can't imagine who you're talking about.
I know. And I was like, are you kidding right now? Like, that's a joke. You know, that's like such a blanket statement. You're never going to leave California again. Not if I can help it. Okay. Yeah. It's like, what? Yeah, so I think they have to have that same sense of the thirst and hunger for what life has to offer. And that's been my challenge, is finding somebody that is that, and also, you know, can complement the parts of me that aren't as developed and that I don't, like, really focus on as much.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It makes sense. It makes total sense. Yeah. And just know that, you know, my, not that you're asking my advice, but I'll give it
always
real quick.
Implicitly.
I would recommend that you really focus on the emotion behind that, the way you want to feel. Like, what is it going to feel like when you meet that person who has that same sense of adventure? What's it going to feel like when you meet that person where you really feel like you complement and you balance each other? Like, what, like, tap into the emotion that you're going to feel and just start connecting to that, like, intentionally. It's like, I call it basically like love visioning. And but it's not like thinking about a specific person or what the person looks like, because that you don't know, right? You don't know, you don't know where he is, you know, how you're gonna meet him, you don't know any of those things. But you know these emotions that you want to feel and just start connecting to them, because they're already within you, you know?
I like that.
So the more you tap into that, the more it starts to feel like, oh yeah, this is happening. Like, this feels like an inevitable thing.
That's a really great way to phrase it. You know, there's again, I mentioned this friend and mentor, Jordan Lage, who's an actor and teacher in New York at Atlantic Acting School. And he taught me the Atlantic Method, which was started by William H. Macy and David Mamet. And it requires you as an actor to know what you're looking for in your scene partner. And to have in your mind's eye what that looks like, and to keep working until you see it in the other person. And so what I hear when you tell me that is that that's what I need to do with a heart feeling, with that kind of thing, which is really, that's enlightening. You should consider doing this professionally.
Thank you so much.
And thank you.
It's been such a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for sharing. And you know how much I love you. You're the best.
I hope you know how much I love you as well.
I do. I feel it. Thank you. So how can our listeners stay in touch with you and learn more about you?
Instagram is the best way.
Yeah.
And despite my manager's encouragement or pushing me to change it to something easier, my Instagram handle is @ Abe Froman Sausage King, which seven of you might recognize from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. If it's easiest, you can just go through @ Dear Franny.
Well, also,
and look for Paul Walling
and also
and her followers.
I'm going to link to your Instagram in the show notes.
So look at that technology.
I know, it's amazing.
Oh,
just click
future.
A link and they can go right there.
The future. That's
and if
the
there's
best
anything
way.
Else you want me to link to, anything else that you're working on or anything. So
you know my dog would be very upset if we didn't talk about him.
Okay, so Rodney, we can also
Dog Cheagle.
We can link to Rodney's Instagram.
Yeah.
So
And there you have it, my conversation with Paul, who, as you know now, I actually call VP. Thank you, VP, and thank you to all of you for listening. Please be sure to check out the show notes, where I'll have links to all of Paul's social media. And if you are interested in staying in touch with me, you can find me on all social media @ Dear Franny. Say hi. And also, you can stay in touch with the podcast on Instagram and Facebook @ Dear Franny Podcast. If you you like what you hear, please take a moment to subscribe on whichever platform you're listening. That way you won't miss any future episodes. And I would so appreciate a rating and a review if you love us. And if you don't love us, then I don't know, slide into my DMs and tell me why and how we can make the show better, because I want you to love it. But you've listened this far, so I'm hopeful that we can get there. All right, I'm a little bit silly. You know that by now. Thank you so much for listening. Have a beautiful day wherever you are in the world. And until next time.